to episode 3 of Between the Games of Antares. You've got two of your regular hosts this week. You've got me, Jamie Morris.
And you've got me, Josh Peel.
And we've got a special guest this week, which is Andy Croft.
Good evening, fellas.
So, let's start with Antares Day, which we held right here at Entoyment. We're recording at Entoyment, in fact, today. I don't know if that's worth mentioning.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally the place I would come to the minute I win the lottery. I'd be like, right, sweet, I'm off, see you later.
Yeah, get to Entoyment.
Most people
would
be like, I'm getting a Ferrari, I'm getting this, that, I'm going to Entoyment. Yeah. I'm buying near enough everything on the shelves and then that's it.
Well, I mean, suppose if you looked at how much it costs for a table at Entoyment per 4 hours, if you were a millionaire, you could just spend the rest of your life at Entoyment. You could afford to do that.
That's a very good chat.
They serve food.
Yeah.
There's toilets.
You wouldn't actually have to leave.
No. Well, they do close at some point.
They might let me sleep there, you never know.
They might do. If you were a millionaire, they would.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll sponsor them for the rest.
It does feel a little strange coming without miniatures and dice, though.
It does, yeah.
It does.
I feel like I need a D10 so I can roll those 10s on those command checks.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should have brought some dice anyway, just so you could roll them, just to kind of stave off the nervous twitch.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Oh, no. Just like that.
But we are. I wish kind of we were a video podcast, because it's quite a nice little setting. It's not really a sci-fi setting. We're in the role-playing room at Entoyment, which is... I'm sure we'll end up filming some battle reports here at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I want to certainly get round to at some point on one of my weekends off, is booking this place out, because it's great.
It is. So for those of you that came along to the Antares Day, hopefully you'll agree that it is a pretty fantastic venue, and we'll plan to hold some more Antares-related action here in the future. I know we've got a growing community locally. But Antares Day specifically, we ran that at the beginning of October. We had 10 people who came along in the end, not including myself. I was the 11th player, and I did even get a game in myself.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Absolutely spanked.
I did. So I'd managed to play my Virai for the first game, because we had one of our players was en route and didn't manage to get here until after lunch. But yeah, the Virai, unfortunately, then came... I'm pretty sure they were last if you went by total points, just because they had one game and they lost handily. So... Yeah, which is unfamiliar to you. I know, Andy, you've played the Virai quite a few times. Winning against the Virai.
Yeah, that was clearly what caught you off guard. Yes, playing the Algorin and absolutely handing it to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So normally it's the other way around.
I feel like the Algorin are becoming my nemesis, because I actually played...
my nemesis as well. Playing them.
Good point. So, well, how did you guys do on Antares Day? So, Andy, how about you?
I managed a victory, so that was actually a turn up for the Bucks.
Who was it against, or what faction?
That was against the Boromites. That was playing the mission now. We have to test the
transmat.
Test.
It wasn't. It was the data cores, wasn't
data
it? Retrieve the data cores.
I can't remember the guy's name now.
Reese,
that was it, yeah. He played very aggressively, actually, with his transport, and moved right up and got right in my face to try and capture one of my data points to get 3 points. So I had to work pretty hard to stave that off. I managed a narrow victory for that one. But that was game two. Game one, I got my backside absolutely handed to me.
Bye.
It was your friend Byron.
Oh, right, yeah, the Freeborn, yeah.
The Freeborn,
oh, God, yeah.
The amount of firepower just coming my way, and hazard suits just started dropping left, right, and centre, and it all just fell apart.
You wouldn't think it, though, from the Freeborn, because on paper, I look at the Freeborn and I see a fairly paper-thin army, right, in terms of most of their infantry. They've got the Vardanari, who are pretty elite, but they're...
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought they were a match for the
hazards. I think it was a case of the mission didn't help, because you have to break your opponent's army for that mission. And for the hazard suits, you know, I can't stay back and fire because there's just not enough of them.
Right, yeah.
So I had to try and, you know, get towards him and move forward.
Yeah.
So he could just sit back and kind of blow me out of the water, as it were, you know. To be fair to him, that was the ideal tactic not to be too aggressive, just to hang back a little bit. So I can't claim that it was, you know, one-sided or anything like that. You know, he played the game perfectly. But it was, it's still a fantastic game. I just couldn't make any headway.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just one of those games. I mean, I did have a nasty habit of failing command tests as well.
Right.
You know, as I'm prone to doing. I think I had, you know, was it 3 or 4 tens in that first game? So, you know, it's not always the easiest game. And then the last game was against Dave Palmer with his gar.
Oh, that was an epic one.
Absolutely epic game, yeah. It was really close all the way along. It went backwards and forwards.
You had a quite an audience at the end as well.
Yeah. It was one of those classic games, to be honest. And it was a victory to Dave on that one. But it was such a good game that it didn't really matter which way it went, to be honest. It was so much fun.
So,
a brilliant day all round, to be fair.
Awesome. And Josh, what about yourself?
So, first game I played Chris, who's another one of our four shards.
Yeah.
I played his gar. And that was really tight, and it was mainly because I just couldn't shift his actual battle suits.
Right.
I was really struggling to get those kind of hits on it to actually do any real damage, and when I did, he'd make a remarkable... Oh, I've rolled a one. I've absolutely just bounced dumped that all plasma the pins. Cannon shot off of, off of this suit, and it's like, oh, great. But did manage to get a narrow victory against his gar. Game two, played Lily, who beat you. With her Algorin, and bless her, she got so unlucky. She got, because that was when we were playing the 85 points, which allowed us to have a force level 2
unit.
So I took a combat drone, the big one, and she got 2 shots on it, both penetrating hits in 2 separate turns. The first turn she rolled a 9 on the destruction chart, and the second time she rolled a 10.
So like, yeah, just all it mattered to is an extra couple of pins.
And that was it, bless her. So man, again, got the victory on that one.
And that's a big, tough unit, because that's the C3M25 you're talking about?
It is, yeah.
Right, yeah.
So,
C3M4. No, the M25 is too expensive for the... that's right.
It's pretty tough when that happens to you, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you've got the big plasma cannon or whatever, you easily beat the armour, and then you just roll rubbish on the vehicle chart.
It's like, here's for a 1, it's 10.
But then I think those moments become more memorable. So I know I've had debates with people before about how spiky it sometimes feels, but I do feel like it's because you remember the moments where you didn't get the roll that you needed, or where you did get the roll that you didn't think you were going to get.
Yeah, 100% agree.
I don't think I would change it, though. I definitely feel like having a chance to pass that one in a million.
Yeah,
one in 10 technically.
It's got to be that chance that, oh my god, you've just been hit by something mega, but it's a sci-fi game, you're going to have to shrug some stuff.
Yeah, of course.
It kind of makes sense.
I mean, I don't know, it's hard to sort of suggest changes or improvements or whatever when, you know, you've not done a huge amount of playtesting around it, but it does feel sometimes like if you've got a, you know, little pea shooter, you could roll brilliantly on the vehicle damage chart and destroy it potentially, but you can have a massive plasma cannon and it'll just bounce right off, or maybe do a couple of pins and that's it. And so it feels like maybe the weapon could influence that a little bit.
Yeah,
potentially, yeah.
But how you would get that into the game, I don't know. So
I think you'd probably do it with pins, right? Like maybe if you get hit by something that exceeds your armor value by a certain amount, you get extra pins as a result. But you're right, without playtesting something like that, it's difficult to come up with a house rule that you would say, yes, that fixes that perceived problem.
Yeah,
you could almost say as well, you know, whatever the weapon you are using, however much that beats the, I don't know, the toughness value by, add that to your roll when you roll on the damage chart. So if you are using like a plasma howitzer or something like that, which is, I think, strike value of 15, and you're rolling against something that's only a toughness value of 9, then you get a +6 to your d10 roll.
Wait a second, strike value 15?
I think it is.
We have to look that one up, surely.
Yeah, that's unbelievably huge.
That, I mean, if so, I'm definitely putting one of those in my next.
I'm either thinking it's a strike value 15 or it's a toughness 15 on the...
I think it's res 15.
Yeah, res 15, sorry, on the...
I kind of wish it was strike value 15.
Strike value 15.
I think the highest I've seen is going to be, what, like strike value 9, I think? That's like a heavy mag cannon, I think, is probably in that sort of territory. Yes. Even so, though, that's still phenomenal, because I've seen someone using a heavy mag cannon on the back of a broodmother. And anything it hits is just going to get pink misted, even tanks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But we've gone off on a tangent. Yep, what was your game three?
So game three was against Threeborn and Byron.
Oh, right, yeah.
Oh, my God. That was the tightest game I had all day.
Right.
I was because it was the one where we had to capture the objective or capture one of the rogue drones.
Yeah.
And then if you had a drone, you could try and take it off your table edge.
Mm-hmm.
But there was two. So I got one of the drones.
And yeah.
Basically, my squad was horrendously pinned down.
Yeah.
So being pragmatic, I then got my plasma cannon and shot the other one and just well, let's just get rid of that one.
Yeah. Smart.
Got rid of that. So I had the only one, kept going down. And then in, I think it was turn five, somehow managed to rally them.
Right.
And get them running. And then just daisy chained it from there and managed to get it back into my own table half, out of line of sight.
Right, okay.
There was no way he kind of was then going to catch up with me.
Yeah. But
again, those freeborn squads, my God, they put out so many shots.
Yeah, well, because their base squad size is six. And yeah. I think, if I remember rightly, he had... upgraded squad sizes just because it was an extra couple of points and you know, where are you going to spend those points?
I think you know, the list I took was 100% not influenced at all by any means of what I only had painted. But sure. If I was to do it again, I would absolutely have had more infantry squads because I only had two, and that did prove problematic at times.
That's interesting because I'm starting to come around to that kind of way of thinking now myself with more infantry squads. But I when I started playing Antares, I didn't want to take tons of infantry, especially standard infantry, whatever your standard infantry is for any given faction. Part of that is because I want variety. I want to include all those cool units. Yeah. But I'm now like with if I build an Algorin force of say 100 points, I'm probably going to have three or four AI squads in there just because they're points efficient. They are going to be the backbone of your force, and just the amount of firepower that you can put out from them, especially with something like those or the Freeborn, where you've also got the micro-X launchers as well.
Yeah, for sure. So. I mean, like, in my list, I think my combat support drones are 9 points, whereas a strike squad of Concord is 10. So for that extra point, I'm getting 5 models, plus a spotter drone, which I could just burn at some point if I get a shot.
Yeah.
Like a key one that I need to get rid of, so...
Is that 9 points just the base?
Oh, no.
Or is that with the batter drone?
That's with the battlefield and with the spotter. So.
But the battlefield's so easy to lose with just a lucky. That's always the first thing I remove with a lucky shot.
Get rid of that battlefield.
Yeah.
It's quite tempting to go with the plasma light support, though, isn't it?
You know, sure.
It's a decent weapon.
Yeah.
And you get them on the same frame as the Concord Strike squads anyway.
Yeah, I've got a box. One of my friends got the two-player starter set from Skytrax.
Right.
And was like, I'm only going to use the Algorin. Do you want this box? I was like...
Yes, please.
So I haven't got another box of Concord Strike
in. Oh, wow.
So that would be 4 squads, 4 drones. Just throw that out, see how that goes.
Nice.
But... I digress. So yeah, no, the tournament went really well. I finished second. Only Josh would beat me, and that was because he got a secondary more than me.
Yeah, so one thing about the Antares Day, I keep referring to it as a tournament, but I feel like that doesn't describe really what we were doing with Antares Day, because it wasn't really a tournament. We deliberately matched up players so that we had every matchup had an experienced player and a less experienced player. Not necessarily having a less, but every match had to have an experienced player. And so what that meant was, with you and Josh Wood coming first and second, really to establish who was, because you won all your games, to establish who was number one, it should have gone to a play between you guys.
You can still play that game.
Yeah, I think so.
We will play that game. I will change my list. I will spike his minis and his dice, but we'll absolutely play that game at some point.
I think to flip it to a narrative kind of style event obviously would have required a lot of planning.
Yeah.
You know, there would have been a lot more effort required to go. And it would be really good fun to do that.
Yeah.
But I think it would take more time to prepare that, to, you know, to then have that overarching story that you could then run through your games.
Yeah.
To be fair, that sounds almost like it needs a couple of months to do something like that. And dare I say it, why should we keep it to ourselves? That should be something we film and then
We
get to follow along with it as well. And maybe that's something we could look at in the future.
I think so. I like the idea that we put more of a campaign style narrative on top of the games that we're playing. I know we've done that a little bit with battle reports we've put on the Nexus, like we had that with the Virai versus Concord campaign.
Yeah, it was nice to chain a couple of games together. We did 3 in that sort of series.
That's right.
It was really good fun because it just you know, even though I lost all three games, it fed into the story.
Yeah, you were a glutton for punishment.
I did actually do myself a disservice there, didn't I? Because I had 50% of the points.
That's true,
had,
yeah.
Rather than you having 50% more than me.
Exactly.
I read it the wrong way around. So,
yeah, you know, we both had.
Didn't make it easy for myself.
No, that's true. And to be fair, if you were going to pick two factions that are mismatched, I think Virai and Concord would be the two I would pick, because Concord, although they've got some close combat capability in the what are they?
Drop troops.
No, not even the drop troops. The Crass.
Oh, yeah.
Although the drop troops are handy as well, but the Crass, yeah, I would say, are there.
To be the guys that...
Yeah, but they don't compare to the Virai, and the Virai are so fast that the Concord don't get a lot of time at range where they should excel.
Yeah.
I think there's an element as well of picking scenarios. I think if we'd done more of a defensive-based scenario where you could have just stayed back, that might have changed it, because you did have a couple of games where you were forced to come forward.
Yeah, and, but then I think, you know, you could also argue that that just purely represents the Concord being caught on the back foot.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
By a scenario that they weren't expecting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's just the very beginning of it, where they are losing massively.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to then take time for them to...
And they were all close games.
Yeah, yeah,
in the end. So, well, yeah, one wasn't.
One wasn't.
Yeah. But, okay, so for someone who played Concord for like a year at least before you went onto the Algorin, you've now had like a good 6 months or so to be playing the Algorin. Do you have a preference between those two factions, or not really?
To be honest, I think Antares is the sort of game that you enjoy playing every faction,
yeah,
for a while, and then you move on to something else, and,
yeah,
you know, you play another faction for a bit. And I don't think I'm going to have a favourite, actually. I think,
okay,
I'm just going to keep working my way through the factions,
right,
and I'll start back at the beginning again. So, but what I have found is that the Algorin, particularly the Special Division that I've gone for, are more suited to close combat, and
yeah,
I have a tendency to try and get stuck in, whereas perhaps I should hold back.
Right.
So it does sort of favour my playstyle a little bit, but having said that, you know, that also means that I should play the Concord more and learn when to stay back and, you know, and use your firepower at,
yeah,
a distance. But, you know, sometimes you feel like that's not always the most fun game, just sitting, you know, too far away and,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
shooting from a distance. So, you know, I think it's, I think, to be honest, I think I'll never have an absolute preference. I'll just,
yeah,
you know, enjoy playing something for a bit and move on. And that's the beauty of Antares, I think. Really.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Have you got any other factions that you're eyeing up for like the next one you want to start collecting, or have you still got more that you want to do with the Algorin?
I have a Gar army that's like ready to go. It's in its boxes, you know,
yeah,
staring at me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I bought the original starter set.
Oh, right, yeah, the Xylos Horizon.
Yeah, yeah, so I got 6 battle suits with that.
Nice.
So then I bought the starter army that you could get, and I've got a command crawler as well. So I've got a decent sized,
yeah,
army there that's just waiting for a bit of time and a bit of attention, really.
Nice.
Have
you thought about colour schemes?
I did a test model that was like the kind of grey, slightly darker than the kind of box art.
That's right, I remember. Yeah.
And I did that, and it looked all right. I'm not sure it suits the Gar.
Right.
I think it's too clean.
Okay.
I think they need a kind of more grungy, rusty, kind of slimy kind of appearance, I think. Mm. So I was talking to Dave Palmer, you know, about his Gar, because they're all metal and they look really,
yeah,
nice. And he was saying that, you know, the next thing to do is kind of weather them up a bit and grind them up. And I think that's the way to go.
I've gone the other way, you see, because I started with my Gar. I got kind of lazy when I painted them. I'd sprayed them white, then I picked out the areas that needed to be black, and then because I couldn't be bothered to basically put any amount of effort into them, I just covered them in army painted dark wash. I was intending at the time to then, I was only going to use the dark wash in the crevices, and then like pick out the plates in something lighter. But originally I liked the way that it looked, because it made them look kind of oily and, like you say, a little bit grungy. And so I said, yeah, that's the aesthetic I'm going to go with. only to later change my mind and decide I really liked the kind of the vanilla white, black and white sort of colour scheme. So I ended up it didn't take much effort to then just put a layer of white on all the raised areas of my garden. And I much prefer the way they look now, despite the fact that I think you're right, like having a very clean look for the garden seems odd. But then I justify it in my head as well. They're not using, it's not like they're using fossil fuels to power their suits. They're using like a plasma reactor or something radioactive, which wouldn't make them look grimy necessarily. So I don't know.
But, whatever suits, isn't it? But I think because I've got, you know, the Concorde, which are quite clean and sharp looking, and then, you know, my Ogryn, again, another clean looking, kind of the Spartan green or whatever. Mm. I think just doing something a bit different. So I'm going to try and go for it. I'll do a test mini and try and do it like rusty, I think.
Yeah.
Just nice browns and a bit of dry brushing of the silver on the edges and go for a really rusty look, see how that goes. Nice. So yeah, that's the next project. But then, you know, I played your Freeborn and I was looking at those and I thought, oh, they're lovely. So, you know, and then I look at the Isaurians, particularly the new
squad, form ones. Yeah.
I really like that infantry squad as well. Yeah. So every time I look at something, I just go, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that.
What about yourself, Josh? You got any next faction lined up?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this the other day. Originally, I was looking at Gar and I was thinking, oh, I might go for Gar, get some Gar stuff. And then I thought, actually, I kind of like the idea of Virai.
Oh, okay.
So my kind of theory would be to have them like the, what they call them, the squiddies in the Matrix.
Oh, yeah, like
black and that gunmetal grey, a little bit of chipping and stuff like that. That would be
be cool.
That's what I was thinking, like a little bit, like almost that cyberpunky type thing.
Yeah, I see that.
I like the idea of Boromites as well, but it's not really... I like Quick. Boromite is not Quick.
They are not, no. As for me, my next faction is Vol. So
I remember you saying you're getting it through printed, aren't you?
That's right. I've been saying it for ages, but Chris, one of our Four Shards players, has agreed to devote his 3D printer to some Vol for me. So I'm going to be away next month, but I'm hoping that by the time I get back, I'll have a couple of squads of Vol to paint, and I'm looking forward to getting the airbrush on them. Because I did a test model without an airbrush a few months. I say a few months. It was like a year ago now. Must have been a year and a half. But since I've gotten the airbrush, I feel like that organic kind of texture would quite suit that. I don't know if I'll stick with the purple colour scheme, but definitely have a bit of a play with that.
The airbrush certainly allows you to get that kind of difference between the underside and the top side the gradient, of a creature. That sort of seems to work for natural, you know, shapes much better. Like,
well, one of the nicest things is one of the Vol infantry units, they are Vol Mist Hunters, who are essentially not, they look like normal Vol in terms of the model, but they have like cloaking essentially. So you print them in transparent resin and you don't have to paint them.
Done.
Job's a good one. So I think I've got a couple of units of those. I've already got my Askar. I might paint half of each of the Vol models so it looks like they're kind of shimmering in and out.
Yeah, but depends. It would be nice to see more Vol on the tabletop. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
because having access to it, doesn't it?
I mean, it's obviously it's not. It's still an extra hobby, isn't it? 3D printing itself, so it's not that easy to get your hands on a Vol army at the minute. But it's that omnipresent kind of or ever-present threat that's talked about in the Antares that sort of doesn't materialise on the tabletop that often.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd be interested to see if they do any more rules for Vol, because I know obviously they're limited at the moment by what models they've got access to print. And Joey Pruitt last year did a really great job with the Vol designs, but sadly he passed away. I think it was at the end of last year. And as far as I'm aware, no one's been lined up yet to do more models. But obviously, it gives us a clear indication of the aesthetic that the Vol have. I'm not sure where even like vehicles fit into that. I don't know whether they're planning on like an organic way of doing it, where they don't have vehicles as such, but just larger Vol or like monstrosities, or whether they will actually have vehicles. But what they would look like, I have no idea. So, be interesting to see.
Yeah, because they are obviously very alien in the fact that they've got that interaction between the different creatures that make up a what we would call a vol, I suppose.
Yeah. That's like there's a cephalite and is I think the head, and I can't remember what the other one. Ambulite. Yeah. It's the legs. I can't remember. Torsite. There we go. I keep saying I can't remember, but I know them. I should have made that a quiz question, but never mind.
I'm glad you didn't.
Millepoix.
And then someone then took the cephalite, the head part, and turned it into a probe model, which works quite well because, as you say, it's a hybrid of these three creatures, and that one just kind of sits in like a little anti-grav basket of sorts.
That's cool.
But then you've got the same model can be used. So you've got the Mist Hunters, like I mentioned before, and then you've got two different versions. I think it was like the Fire Hearth and the something at Storm Hearth. That are two different versions of the same infantry. So it's the same model, different weapon, but they look very similar. And then I think you can print a normal Vol model as slightly bigger to represent like a Hearth Mother. But then at that point, you run out of official models for the Vol, and you've got Askar as well. You've got enough there probably for, I think, a small force, but I know they've been very clear with that's what they're calling the leading claw selector, which sounds like a scouting force for the Vol.
Mm.
Kind of like the I'm loath to make comparisons to the Tyranids. But obviously the Tyranids hive sort of swarms had that same kind of progression of they introduced them as like, oh, this is just like the edge of a wave of Tyranids and there will be more coming later. And while the Vol are a very different kind of beast, they're more like an insect swarm or hive of creatures with their own kind of society. I would be interested to see if they utilize other races in the same way that they utilize the Askar. So you could, even if it's non-canonical, you could get away with just looking at other 3D print ranges and picking out large monstrosities and saying, right, in lieu of having a vehicle, I'm going to take the stats for a broodmother and put them on this Vol monstrosity that they've just tamed from one of their planets and just use that. So I think there's definitely scope for the Vol to be expanded until such a time as we have rules that expand on them officially.
I think it's nice that they're there for Antares to kind of expand into that extra kind of faction, but as a game it doesn't really feel like you always need more factions.
No, you don't, no.
I think often other games will just constantly have more and more stuff being added all the time. You can't keep up with it. Where it's nice with Antares that you've got factions that actually there's enough there for a player to go, yeah, I'll play them, and then I'll play them, and I'll play them. And actually, it's more fun to work your way through.
Yeah, the ones that already exist. The ones that
are already there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like the game needs that much more.
No.
But having said that, it'll be interesting to see what comes for the Vol.
Yeah. I think the only counterpoint I would make to that is because of the way that they've written the Antares story, I do feel like it lends itself to exploring your own ideas for factions, with the caveat that when you introduce your own faction, you should probably just base it off of the stats for an existing one. So you could just say take the Algorin, but I'm going to use completely different models, and they're not called the Algorin anymore, because I want to invent my own backstory for it. Like the narrative lends itself very much to doing that. But I don't think, to your point, the game doesn't need new factions, because the factions that are already there kind of represent everything that you need from the game itself.
The only danger of obviously basing your own force off what's already there is that you then have something that plays like the stuff that's already there.
True, yeah.
And so obviously it's nice to have something different. I think that's partly why I'm looking forward to playing the Gar next, is that they will be very different. The human type factions, the Algorin and the Concord that I've played so far. I think it's having that variation in the way that an army plays that's key, really.
Yeah, it's interesting that you both mentioned the Gar as one of your upcoming faction choices, or potential upcoming faction choices, because I did a bit of analysis on, because I'm a bit of a spreadsheet nerd, as you both know, I did a bit of an analysis on our local player group. So we've got 11 players, whether they're actively collecting or just starting to get into the game, and three who are currently actively collecting have Gar, possibly four, because I think Josh Wood has Gar already, but they're not painted.
Let's just put it out there, I'm not sure there's a faction Josh Wood doesn't have.
No, that's true. Virai, he doesn't have the Virai.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, yeah, so he's one behind me. But yeah, Gar are a very popular second faction, I think, because of just what you said. They play very differently to any other faction. And they're cheap.
Really fun.
Yeah,
a bit unpredictable, you know.
Iconic.
Yeah.
The way they look.
They can go disastrously wrong, you know. I think they're great.
They feel like the, although you used to say about the Vol being like these antagonists that are in the narrative and looming a lot, the Gar feel more like the front and center antagonists, but without them being like a big existential threat. Because realistically, the Concord and the Isaurians don't really care about the Gar. They're not really that big of a threat. So, yeah. So, Tale of Four Shards. We've recently published part two. And we're currently in the process of writing part three. How are you guys getting on with your write-ups of part three? Not that I want to grill you on your progress.
Mine is very much all there, 100%, just not on paper in my mind.
Oh.
So I know exactly what I'm going to write about, because obviously I had to think about it. I just haven't got around to typing it up yet, but I will get there. I'll probably, to be fair, do it tonight when I get home.
There you go.
It's fresh in my mind and while we've had this chat, but I didn't actually order too much this time round because my painting backlog is a little bit long.
That's
and distinguished.
Right.
So, yeah, but then my next lot for the next order has gone a bit rogue. So.
Oh, right, okay. What about you?
Yeah, I've started writing into the document. I'm just doing it a bit at a time, kind of piecemeal, just as I think of stuff, you know, just writing it down and try and edit it into something that's legible, readable later.
Nice.
But yeah, it was kind of helped by my choice for this month of the Algren Liberator X06.
Oh yeah,
lovely model. Took a lot of prep time before I could actually get to painting it, obviously with resin.
Yeah,
it's worth spending that extra time just so your paint doesn't peel off later.
How was the fit for it? I'm curious.
Not too bad.
Yeah.
Not too bad. Yeah, the there's not that many bits to it. You've got that huge chunk of resin that's the body.
Mm.
The wings for it fitted absolutely perfectly.
Okay.
And the front piece that you have to put on had a bit of a gap there that needed filling, but nothing, you know, nothing too drastic. What I did find was that I always do this with models. I always have to tweak the aesthetic of them just a little bit. You know, I can never just put it together as it is. And,
okay.
Yeah, that's fine. And I felt like the gun was kind of just stuck on the top of the turret just a little bit too much, you know.
Yeah,
wanted it kind of in line a bit more, so that required a bit of chopping of the metal and getting that in the right place and a bit of filling and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it gave me something a bit more to talk about, you know, with only having the one model for this month. So
okay,
and obviously painting wise, it made it life a little bit easier.
Yeah,
not having loads of models to try and get through.
It was a lovely paint job as well.
Yeah, I like to be able to focus on models like that. It's kind of nice. It's nice that the amount of detail is kind of just right for getting things on the tabletop. You know, they're not so detailed that you have to spend ages painting them and you never get anything finished. But at the same time, they're not so plain that you're just done straight away and they don't look very good on the tabletop. You know, they seem to have hit that sweet spot with most of their models, I feel, for this particular game.
You can either go like, you can go one way or the other. You can do like a nice simple paint job and it's like, it's really effective, it's a real good three colour scheme, it's great. Or you could go like, but I'm going to do loads on this, and it's got that, it's that blank canvas that works really well either way.
Yeah, I found with the C3M25, the big Concorde vehicle, it was the first time I'd tried an airbrush on a vehicle, and I hadn't thought to use one originally because it's flat panels, and to me, the airbrush naturally feels better for organic models because you get the gradient. Mm. But actually, it worked really, really well. I think I was basing it heavily off of the Canon paint scheme for the C3M25, but it has this gradient between like a olive green or a camo green to the white. And I tried to...
impossible to do by hand.
Exactly. But doing it with the airbrush, it was really satisfying and it worked really, really well. I've never tried it before, but I'm definitely going to be trying that with a lot of my vehicles going forward, because otherwise I find just even with a large brush, like, you just, it feels a little bit of a chore sometimes when you're trying to cover those flat panels and trying to make it feel a bit more interesting than just a flat color.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, that Liberator that I was painting, it was lots and lots of dry brushing. And it did take a while to build up the effect that I was after. But, you know, it worked.
You were edge highlighting that as well, weren't you?
It was sort of half edge highlighting, half dry brushing.
Right.
It was sort of in between the two techniques, you know. It was, it wasn't one or the other, really. But the Algarin vehicle definitely lends itself to that more than the Concorde.
There's a lot more edge.
Yeah, so you've got those
hard edges
to try and catch. And you've got those lovely little panels in the wings where they've got these little triangle panels.
Yeah.
So you can get a nice wash in there and then dry brush over it and get those effects in. So it did lend itself to that.
Nice. And then we've got part four, which we'll be doing at some point. It's probably going to be the new year, realistically, before we actually get it put together and even just do the content for it. But we've got something in mind for that, which is a big finale for the Tale of Four Shards. So we've been doing it for, I think we started it maybe in like May, it must have been this year. And we haven't put out an article every month. I know we had a bit of a lull over the summer, but it feels like four articles kind of covering the way that each of the armies is built up, and then culminating in like a big, hopefully four-way battle, maybe even a five-way battle if I can pull together enough units in one faction to oppose four players at once. I don't know if I can.
I reckon you've probably got it in you somewhere.
I'd probably have to pool several factions. The biggest faction I have is the Gar. And I reckon I could do a 300-point Gar army.
Oof.
Maybe. If I upgraded everything, I could probably do a 300-point Gar army. Because I've got the Gar Rebel starter set as well.
Yeah.
So between that and the original Gar army and then all the extra bits I've acquired, yeah. But then we've got a Gar player. Maybe what I need to do is get a VRI swarm. I need to get some more VRI models.
Yeah,
that would be quite intense, though, like playing players. You know.
Yeah.
It'd be like the first game I ever played when me and Josh Wood faced off against your VRI.
Oh, yeah.
And just halfway through the game, I just randomly shot one of his models because I was like, they're there. He's like, why are you shooting me? It's like, oh, can you there?
Yeah, so we'll figure out something suitably epic, I think, or whether we have like a mini tournament or something like that.
We've got to have a big sort of send-off for it, really.
Absolutely. And then we'll be planning for another, possibly another edition of Tale of Four Shards. We're lining up other players locally, which is part of the way we're kind of building a local following. We've always said it's not easy to get people to play their first game of Antares, but it's very easy to get them to play their second. And getting them to play their first quite often is just a case of, you know, running a demo game saying, would you like to come and take part in this campaign we're doing? You don't need any models. And even before you say, oh, by the way, we'll pay for the models for you, the people will jump at the chance. So we've got, I think we've got four, in fact, five people who want to be in part two. We're going to have to get them to fight it out for the top four. But we had, so last week I came down with Josh Wood to Entoyment. We had two new players. So one who's playing Boromites against my Algarin, and another was playing Gar against Josh's Isaurian. Bearing in mind that Josh is currently the regional champion of Antares, and he very almost had his posterior handed to him by someone who hasn't played any war games before.
Oh, I love
so,
that.
It was a very close game. It went on for quite a while. They were playing in the Wild West, which was...
Yeah,
I wish we'd gotten some more photos.
This.
Yeah, it was a good... That's what I like about Antares. You can pick any aesthetic, any setting that you want.
Do what you like.
Yeah. So, I think he's leaning towards Gar after that good experience. And then, who knows for the other two factions. I think we're going to try and encourage people to pick factions that we don't have a lot of representation of locally. So, which is why I was doing my bit of spreadsheet nerdiness. So we need more Virai, more Freeborn, more Boromites. Those are the three that only I have at the moment painted up.
Do we need more Freeborn, though?
We've
both played against them.
I've played against the Freeborn a couple of times, and I've not seen some of the nicest models on the tabletop yet. Mm. So, yeah, the skimmers. Mm. I like the two-person skimmer.
Yeah.
I remember its name now.
I know the one you mean, Striker? Or maybe Intruder. Intruder, I think those are the Algren sort of bike.
Yeah.
Ones. I think it's the Striker, maybe.
Yeah.
But another one you mean. Cool. Yeah, and then also the Freeborn have got the whole... you can do like a Rogue Nuhu force as well and have a bunch of misgenics. I know Josh Wood's quite keen to have like a zombie horde of misgenics with just like one Nuhu controlling them all.
That would be pretty epic.
What
happens if the Nuhu controlling them all gets killed?
I don't know. I mean,
here we go. Here's the house rule you have. You just have to roll their order dice. So order dice comes out, roll. Oh, they're rallying.
Funny you should say that. So that's basically how somagrafts work. I say that. They don't work like that. So the somagrafts, you choose when you want to activate them, but once activated, they are active for the rest of the game. And what they allow is for you to pass any order test on a roll of a 9 or less. Mm. So regardless of how many pins you've got, you are now much more likely to pass. But if you do roll a 10, then from that point onwards, the somagraft is malfunctioning and you do have to roll the order die.
Excellent.
So I love how chaotic that might be, but you pair that with misgenic abilities, which can make them quite lethal in close combat, potentially. But those are random as well. Mm. Right? I think you get to choose one and then you get to roll for a second one. I'd be interested to see how that might turn out. But it could either be a very short game because they don't have any range capability, or a very short game because they are deadly in close combat.
Exactly. They've got them in your face.
The only problem with the misgenics is the models. I love 50% of them and I hate the other 50%.
Right. Which 50% do you like? Because they come in misgenics A and misgenics B. Do you like
it's
one?
Half of each.
Ah, oh, no.
So what you're saying is we need a misgenics C and D.
Yeah.
You
could suggest it to Skytrax.
To just be able to pick and choose the models. Would be the way forward, because that would definitely then...
Although... In fairness, the misgenics are probably one of the easiest models to just use from any other range.
That is true, yeah.
In fact, in order to support his proposed list, I think Josh Wood wants to use Zombicide miniatures. Because you get like 60 zombies in there, and just for having something on the table, I think that they might not necessarily look the part, but they'll be good enough to represent his zombie horde.
Yeah.
Army options. Do you guys ever take army options, or do you tend to spend your points elsewhere?
I tend to have a few points spare, I always find, that I end up using up with army options. I always find that my favourite is Get Up. Because I always think I need that get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
I know. Whenever I use it though, I always roll like a two. whereas if I don't use it,
I'll end up rolling a 10
every time. So whenever I've used it, I've never needed it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do quite like the option of having it there.
Yeah, you're right. That one is actually one of the more handy ones. What about yourself? Do you?
I have never used any army options, mainly because I'm struggling for points. So we've said, like, I played games where it's like, oh, we'll play 60 points. And I'm like, right, so what drone is losing its spotter buddy?
Yeah, okay.
Working out from that. I've never got to that point where I've been like, oh, I'm at 59 points. I could get a block or something like
that. I think
that's
the difference, though, with like the Concorde. I found that a lot of the basic units have the probe already, the bully probe with them, the spotter, whereas the hazard suit squads don't have a probe with them as standard.
Right.
So if you add it in, then they're getting really quite expensive for points, because they're already 14 points.
Mm.
I think that's for only four guys as well, I believe.
So
adding the extra guy, they're really quite expensive. So I always find that I've got those few little points left over. And rather than make the units themselves more expensive, it's more useful to go for the army option.
Okay. I suppose that usually by making the unit more expensive, you're in theory making the unit more survivable or more lethal. But certainly adding like an extra guy for Freeborn are a great example of that. Like they, I don't think I would take army options in almost any scenario because I'll always just add extra bodies into the unit. Gar as well, like, you know, if I've got a unit of outcasts, adding an extra couple of bodies to those units, especially given how many shots they pour out, can be quite effective. It makes them more survivable, but of course it does mean that, you know, you run out of ammo for the whole unit. That's, you potentially wasted some of those points. So it's a bit of a, it's a bit of a funny one. I don't tend to use them myself.
It's always working out where the trade-off is, you know, for something that you're definitely going to use, whereas something that you might use but could be incredibly useful when you do use it.
Yeah.
And it's getting that balance right.
So it's interesting, though, that you went straight for get-up, because my go-to, if I do take an army option, is almost always block. It might just be because, having not used army options a great deal, I tend to go for whatever is the simplest one for me to remember.
Yeah.
Like first off, to remember that I even have it, because I think a couple of times I have taken something like Get Up, or there's a Marksman one.
Yeah.
That's quite good. And I'll either not use it because I'm thinking, no, there's probably a better time that I can use this later, and then it just never comes up. Or I don't use it because I forgot completely that I have it. Whereas Block, there's a very obvious point at which I'll remember that, which is I really want the next door to die.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder if I've got a block, and then I use that.
But the problem I find with block is that you've got to be in a position where your dice is likely to come out, you know.
Or you're desperate enough to need it.
Well, that's it. But yeah, you could be in a scenario where you're desperate for it, but it's only a 50-50 chance or worse that your dice will come out. So, you know, and then it's wasted. So I tend to go for ones that I find that I will definitely be able to use, or will definitely be able to benefit from when I do use them. Rather than something like block, where I might get the benefit from it, but then, you know, you might not get any benefit at all. So I tend to avoid block, actually.
Right, okay.
But what I do feel is that with the army options, it would be really handy to have a set of cards, like, printed out.
Just think.
Oh, so yeah, yeah.
I have them sat on the table, and it would just be that prompt to go, oh, yeah, I've still got that get up to use, or I've still got, yeah, got marksman or whatever, you know, just to have that visual prompt would be very handy. And I keep meaning to do it, and I've never have.
As soon as you then use it, you can just go, cool, and use get up.
Chuck that to the side, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And have, like, multiples of, so if you've got, like, two get ups or three blocks or whatever.
Yeah. That's a good point. So one of the more interesting kind of army options that I find are the ones that you get from your leaders. So not for any of the standard kind of leader models or command models, but when you upgrade them to be like, you know, a force commander or high commander or anything like that, they usually come with like a special rule that allows you to take a particular type of army option, but also gives you one of those instances for free. I'm struggling to think of any of these specific examples, but it might just be because they're exclusive, because only that model can bring that army option to the table. It feels like more of a boon, because you're already obviously getting the upgrade of having the model itself, and it makes that model more attractive and more unique. It's like the Algren have got Courage Under Fire. So it's an Algren only one, and that. When making a recovery test to put a down order back in the bag, add +2 to the unit's final modified command. So, and on a pass, it removes 2 pins irrespective of the score.
That's quite handy.
Like that.
I think that I would find that very useful.
Yeah. Right? So, like, instead of your get up, that's only 1 point each, depending on the on an army's commander. The other thing about that is it makes the command squad a much more attractive option. Because I've had this when I'm looking at command squads, and they only come with like 3 units by default. They're quite expensive for what they are. And yeah, okay, they've got +1 command compared to a standard infantry unit. But realistically, I'm not usually that bothered about having a high command. I just want more guns on the table.
Well, I mean, just looking at the SD hazard command here, that it's 14 points. You only get 3 models as standard. And Stoic is your army option that you get for free.
Right.
Which I've never found a use for.
So Stoic, let's see. Algren have a strong respect for their superiors. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Before acting on a command unit order, even if it is to go down, this option can be played to immediately remove a pin from a single friendly Algren unit within command radius of the, so typically 10 inches. Okay, so
you've got to have another unit close by, you see, to use it. And it, with the SD, you know, hazard squads, you've not got many squads on the table, so they're going to be spread out.
Yeah.
So you're not going to have another unit close by to make use of it.
Another expensive unit as well.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and then you have to, I think it's to pay another 2 points before you can get marksman, which is useful, but again, it's extra points on top of what you've already paid. And you know, to fill out your squad, it's an extra 2 points, oh no, 3 points per hazard trooper as well. So I think the unit was sort of topping out about 23 points or something like that.
Yeah, which is a lot
when you're playing small points games.
Yeah, even in a 100 point game, if that's a quarter of your army cost, I could see that bit. Yeah, it's a tough sell. But maybe that's what we're missing, is we need to go for bigger points games. But also it occurs to me that in most of the games I've played, I've never done stuff like using the follow rule. The most kind of sneaky I get or advanced that I get is using the reprogrammed die for the Viri, but that's built into their core strategy.
Yeah, but for follow is one of those things that I want it to be part of the game, and I want it to be there and good fun, but I just don't find you can use it very often.
Maybe we need to.
Is the range for that 5 inches as well for follow?
If you're planning on using it and you bunch your units up together, it can be a good way to seize the initiative. Especially, you know, if you are a lower number of units, as you are with the SD squads, when you do draw an order die, you really want to be maximizing the use of something like follow to seize the initiative despite the fact that you have less. Maybe.
It might be that key point where you just need to get guns downfield. It's like,
yeah,
they're advancing towards me, I have not got many, I need to
make
the most of this.
It's risky though. If I remember rightly, you have to take an order test. If either of the units have pins, you have to take an order test, and if you fail, both units take a pin or go down, or there's something negative that happens. I don't know if it's as severe as both units go down, but I do think they both get pinned.
Yeah, I think you do then both fail that command, so it's like it's then two dice out of the bag. But
we should check it. We've got rule books sat on the table right here. So
yeah, no, I was just looking on my on the Army Builder app about what the maximum size squad is I could take of a strike team.
Oh yeah,
it is only 8 troopers. I was kind of hoping that I'd just do like a 15 strong mob squad.
Right,
imagine that 30 shots coming out rapid fire plasma.
With just one order die though.
Yeah,
that's a lot of points to put on one order die. But yeah, when you pull it, that's dangerous.
Follow can activate one other friendly unit within 5 inches of its own unit.
Oh wow, only 5 inches.
It is
so
only 5 inches.
So what's the command radius used for then? Is that just for being able to use your command
for another unit?
Yeah, okay.
So, which is normally 10, but it's 15 for the higher commanders.
Okay.
So I was right on that one. I knew it was pretty damn small. Like, you have to be really close, right on top.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I mean, it's a matter of perspective, really. 5 inches to some people is really big.
What about, so there's one particular army option that I'm thinking of here that there's a lot of army options or a lot of strategies that are based on countering this, which is the Imtel die. So I think I used it in one game, and the Imtel die allows you basically an extra order die that can be used for various different things in the game. But there are then, so there's an army option called Counter Shard that says you can counter the opponent's Imtel die with a +2 bonus. Now, that one feels like a tough choice to take unless you know A, that you're playing against an Imtel faction, and B, that you're playing against an Imtel faction with a commander who typically takes the Imtel die. The fact that that army option exists makes me think that the Imtel die is really good, and we just haven't figured that out yet. Because if there is a counter to it, that suggests to me that you would assume other people are going to take it. Let's have a look at the Imtel die and see what it is that it does.
I must admit, I do feel that with Antares, although we're, you know, reasonably experienced players, there is still a lot of different things within the game that we could be utilising that we haven't scratched.
Yep. Nuances, really. Yeah.
There's a lot there that can be played with, and we're still figuring these things out.
Well, yeah, and things like the Subverter Matrix. That's another great one that
I feel like I should drones, you know, to have that Subverter Matrix.
Right. Okay.
But haven't got around to using that again as well.
Special munitions. Right. I use net and I use blast, and then I don't use a lot of other stuff.
No, it's one of the ones that I've been wanting to try.
Yeah.
Which is the one that makes you have to move?
Scoop.
No, scoop, yeah.
You use that to great effect against my Concorde.
You have to run or go down, I think.
That's right, yeah. Well, you say to great effect, and it felt like it at the time, but what I did was forced your weapon team to keep moving, thus taking your weapon team out of the game for that turn, but it also took my weapon team out of the game for the same turn, and ultimately you moved closer and closer until you then shot me and killed me, because the scoot hadn't dealt pins to you, it hadn't dealt casualties.
That is true. I mean, maybe if then
forcing you off an objective, maybe that would be a really good use.
What's the one that you drop it and it basically stops my hyperlite armor?
That one is
stinking.
That one is stinking. And
Scrambler.
Scrambler. That's the one.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Now Scrambler feels really good. Yeah, because it works against not just the Concorde and the Isaurians, but against Algorin as well. Mm. Any reflex armor, hyperlite armor, phase armor, it nullifies buddy drones and probes in the area, and it's a biggish template, but in an open field of play, it's reasonably easy to just avoid that area. It tends to be really good, I think, against defensive positions.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, it again, if you use that against, say, like the Isaurians with their phase armor, which I find is just so annoying with,
yeah,
with having one being able to, it's reactive where they can just go down.
Yeah,
but you've already acted. I was just going to jump down though. Yeah. So to be able to turn that off and then just be like, right, now you're getting it. Especially if they've already got them, if they've moved up onto the position, then you could drop that Scrambler on them and then just open on them with something that's got a lot of shots. You know, that's then where you'd be like,
yeah,
now we can have some fun.
I think a lot of the reason why I haven't used these different, you know, ammunition types is because I struggle to find overhead fire very effective. I cannot roll like less than a 4 when I need to. For the overhead shots, it's just nigh on impossible.
What about the time when you, despite the fact the Concorde get plus one res when being hit with the blast weapon, my Concorde squad got hit by a blast weapon?
So it literally destroyed the lot.
It's like, where are you gone?
So I suppose, give a bit more context to that. So that was the week after I'd had one of my hazard squads completely wiped out by the overhead guard shot.
The bombard.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and literally wiped out hazard squad in one turn. So I was like, right, I've got to give this a go. So I got the heavy mag mortar, and it did work on that one occasion.
Oh, it's hideous.
And everything since then has just missed.
Yeah,
failed miserably. And I don't know if that's just the way I'm using it, but
it got to the point where I'd written up the report, and Jamie messaged me, I spoke to you because I've gone to pick something up. He's like, did you forget your plus one res with hyperlite armor? I was like, no, it just worked really well.
Yeah.
Just destroyed this entire squad. Like, oh, well, there's my main thrust gone.
Yeah. So I found the army option that we were talking about, Intel Boost, it's called. And it basically gives you an extra Intel dice that's identical to any other dice a faction is using, and only when drawn declared does it become an Intel dice, and it can be used as follows. So it gives you Intel bonus, which is adds plus one to the target number on any single roll. You have to declare it, take it from the order dice before rolling the dice, and note that the die in this instance is taken such as with follow order, not drawn in the normal order of play. So you declare that you're going to make a certain roll or the action that you're going to take, then you take the Intel die out and use it to add plus one. Quite useful. And bear in mind, this is something you can do every turn, not just once a game.
I mean, that'd be useful for things like rolling on the damage chart.
Plus one to the target. Oh, plus one to the target number. Okay, not plus one to the result, because that would be bad. Yeah, okay. So, but that's interesting with the way it words it, to the target number, because on the damage chart, what's the target number?
Always a one, I suppose.
Well.
But then I suppose it's every other number has an effect.
Interesting. I mean, I would certainly allow it on. It would. It feels like maybe they chose to word it the way that they did, deliberately to avoid using it on the damage chart. But it might be worth checking with Master Bancroft himself and establishing whether or not it can be used there. So that's just one of the uses, though. So then you've got evasive tactics. When their order dice is drawn in the normal manner, as long as the Imtel dice has not yet been used, the Imtel player can declare their just drawn die to be put aside, not to be used this turn. So I think the purpose behind that, I remember discussing this because it seemed like evasive tactics was largely pointless, but I think it was to avoid you having to do any, having to actually make an order test in case maybe you don't want to go down.
Or could you use it where you really don't want to go next? You want to see what your opponent does.
But that's to not be used this turn.
But you've got that, so you've got a spare dice for that scenario where it's not affecting.
Oh, I see. That was it. Yeah. So you're just basically, yeah, you draw a die. You don't. You're basically seeding that draw.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So hopefully your opponent will then draw next.
Like having a block, really. Not quite the same as having a block because you're losing the Imtel bonus, but it's essentially like, no, we're going to ignore that and now okay, that makes sense. Next one is Imtel recovery. At the start of a new turn, before any units have moved, a unit with a retained down order can attempt another recovery test. Take the Imtel dice from the bag, put to one side, and attempt a recovery test. If the test succeeds, the unit's order dice is placed into the bag with the others. Otherwise, the retained down order remains.
That's good.
Really useful. Yeah, because the number of times you do have a unit that didn't get up that you wanted to get up, and you get another go. Yeah, and again, you can use it.
If you had that another go, as long as you haven't rolled a 10 the first time, they've lost another pin.
Yeah.
It's then more likely to get up.
Yeah.
Well, in theory.
And then the last one is discarded. If the Imtel dice is unused at the end of a turn, then it is ignored. But that's just ignored for this turn.
Yeah,
right. It still goes back in the bag. But it says then if the users of this army option end a turn with more non-Imtel units in their force than Imtel units, e.g. allies or mercenaries, the Imtel die is lost for the rest of the game. So
makes sense.
Actually, looking at that, so the cost for an Imtel boost is 2 points, but it's free with a Nuhu. So actually, that makes Nuhu even more attractive. But that's actually, on reading that now, that does feel like if you're playing Concord or Senatex, you should probably be taking an Imtel boost in every army list.
There's multiple different ways there that you can use it, so it's not like I have to wait for this specific scenario before I can use it. You've actually got options there, so you can make sure that you use it every turn as well.
And unlike every other almost every other army option, it's usable every turn.
Yeah, because normally you just discard it once you've used it, whereas that, you know, it's going to be hopefully the gift that keeps on giving there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, are we going to see that in more of your Concord lists from now on?
Possibly. I might have to give that a go.
Right, so we're going to have to start then taking Counter Shard. So, and this one's super cheap. So this is, you get two Counter Shards for 1 point, and the Counter Shard comes with like a value attached to it, which depends on your faction. So Freeborn get +3 because they're excellent at shard stripping. And the Viri, who corrupt the Imtel, +2 for Imtel Nations and Algorin, and +1 for Gar, whose technology makes life difficult for the Imtel, and then +0 for the nanosphere-resistant Boromites. So the Counter Shard, as soon as the opponent declares the use of an Imtel dice, the player with a Counter Shard can attempt to deny the Imtel dice usage. Each player rolls a d10, adds their Counter Shard value, and compares the result. All nations gain +1 to the result for each Nuhu in their army. So if you are getting that free with a Nuhu, you're looking at a +3 anyway, because you're an Imtel nation, +1 for the Nuhu. But the Freeborn then are particularly good against the Concord and Senatex for that reason. But even for getting two of them for 1 point, that means in a typical 6-turn game, your maximum you're going to deny is 2.
Yeah, they're still going to be
uses.
And you might as well.
It's still worth taking.
Yeah.
So the only time that I used it, I think I used it for the +1 a couple of times. And I, at the time, the evasive tactics didn't make sense. But what you just said, Andy, makes perfect sense. If you really want the opponent to go next.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we've had numerous games where you know.
Yeah, I didn't want really the. Yeah.
Sure enough, it does.
Just thinking as well, the perfect time when you'd say, I'm just not going to use this dice, this Intel dice, is when that guard distort dice comes out and you just
go, yeah,
you're right.
That is a very good point,
That would be the time to use it there. I would, unless there's something that says you can't do that, I don't know, but
that's my
first of Intel.
Nice, yeah.
Because then even if they're like, well, I'm going to counter shard that, well, you're getting +0, I potentially have a Nuhu, I'm getting +3, let's go.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what I would use it for.
Nice. So I think we're going to definitely see more of the Intel boost. And therefore more counter shard as well. It feels like there's a lot of nuances to tactics that we're just not using. We're very much just like getting lots of guns on the table and just getting into a puncher. But like,
that's for me, especially that's that bolt action in me. I'm not used to having, you know, these army options of, oh, well, I'm now going to do this. I'm just like, run forward with your guns, men. Courage. Courage and honour.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, there's a reluctance to kind of try to use these things at the key time because you think, well, it's going to miss. It's not going to have any effect, whatever. So, therefore, I'm not going to take that unit that would have that option.
Mm.
So
I'm also very influenced by what I've seen other people use. So one of the reasons why I really like X launchers is because I watched a lot of tabletop warlords, and the first couple of battle reports I saw, I think they were taking like two X launchers in their side because that's what models they happen to have. But then for me, I then equated that with a standard list has a couple of X launchers in it, and when they use net ammo and blast ammo primarily, because version one you had to pay for the extra ammo types, I then equate that with, well, net ammo and blast ammo are the two standard ones that I'll use because I understand them. So I feel like maybe some of this is just around getting that first use on the table and then hopefully having a good experience with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some things that I need to do differently as well with, like, taking an X launcher, for example. So I realised that, obviously, you can't always position your X launcher where you want to. So if you put it in line of sight, for example, then it's going to be much more vulnerable. So you want to try and hide it away, but then you don't have line of sight.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a spotter buddy nearby. So obviously you have to have a unit that's got one. But then you end up restricting the use of that other unit because you can't move them too far away because then you can't patch sight in. So, you know, maybe actually taking a 5-point shard of spotter probes would actually be a much better use of points, so that you can then have a couple of those dotted around to make sure you can always patch into something to give you that line of sight.
Yeah.
So you're always rolling on a 4. Okay, it's still a 40% chance of hitting.
That's the thing, like probes as well. Like another one, other than Tectorists, I tend to take the Tectorists because they're amazing. But I don't take many of the probe units in my lists.
Yeah.
Even though they're actually really useful.
I've started to use them a bit more actually. So the targeted probes I tend to use, but the hound probes.
Hound probes.
Experimentation.
Yeah, and they've been incredibly effective. And it's only taken us a year and a half to get to that point. hound probes are new to V2, right? So we've been playing now for like 2 years.
Yeah,
longer.
I think it's coming up to 2 years. I think we've been playing
V1 and V2. So yeah, a couple of years, but a year and a half of version 2 before we started using hound probes. So who knows? It'll be another year and a half before we start using scrambler, and then
well, we've got plenty of mileage left in this game.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah. Okay, so we've come to our quiz for episode 3. I've already had Josh and Andy write down their answers to the quiz so that this time we don't have any pollution of answers between them. So I'm going to read out the questions and then you listeners can also play along, see how many you get out of 10. I've got a mix of rule questions and lore questions, which have flummoxed, I think, both of our...
Yeah, I didn't know. I had to, like, read up.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, my last quiz effort was a 6 out of 10. It ain't getting better than that, so I've already peaked.
Nice. Well, let's see how you did. So question 1, explain the function of a fractal lock.
So I said it locks the war chest of a guard battle suit, leading to them running out of ammo.
Nice. Any other answers?
So I said that it increases the damage with each shot at the same target.
Interesting. So what you're thinking of, I think, is breaching, which is quite often related to fractal lock. But no, it's actually if you hit a target, you acquire a fractal lock until the target moves, or you shoot at a new target. While you have a lock, you don't have to roll to hit the target.
Oh,
that's useful.
I was avoiding mentioning the fractal lock because when we were talking about X launches and homing in on the target, I wanted to say, oh yeah, like a fractal lock.
Well, when do you use this?
but no, I didn't mention it, and I kind of feel like maybe I should have done. But I do like. I think if I was giving out bonus points for style, that's one for you, Josh.
We'll go for like a style point.
Style points, yeah, okay. Well, let's note that down. So that's 0, 1, and for style points, you get 1. No, 0, 0, and 1. Okay, question 2. The Viri reprogrammed die can be used by architectors to perform one of two actions. What are these actions called, Josh?
Well, I don't think this is right, but I just remember you using an architect and getting your guys to get really close to mine and Josh's when we played, so I've just put run and sprint, but I don't think that's right.
Those are not the actions in question. Andy?
I've got reset as one of them, but I couldn't think of the other one for the life of me, where you get to have another go.
Reset is indeed one of them. Overclock is the one that you're thinking of. Overclock is the one I use the most. Actually, but I'm not surprised that you deleted that from your brain.
Yeah. Well, I think it has been a while now since I actually played your Viri. So.
We'll probably do another game then.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Question 3. What is the strike value for a Gar Plasma Claw?
So initially I put too much, and then I put 4.
Strike value 5.
Andy is correct.
Yes. So close.
Now, the only reason I know that is because that's one of the things that definitely changed from version 1, because it used to be a D5 strike
value. I think they even changed it in the errata in version 1.
The event kind of rule pack.
Right, yeah, that's right, because it did start as a variable strike value. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. Strike value 5, so they are quite devastating, but only one attack, which is... makes them slightly less terrifying, but you're right, too much.
Too much. There we go.
So, question 4. What is the name of the larvan breed used as mounts by Boromite Rock Rider squads?
Upper larvamites, but I don't think it is. I think they're an independent thing.
Larvamites is the small larvan units.
Yeah, I didn't have an answer at all for this. I'm not up to speed on my Boromite names at all.
It's locomites.
So it was a mite of some description.
Out of pity, I think I'm willing to give you half a point unless you really are aiming for 0.
I mean, to be fair, at this point, I'll take what I can get.
So let's give you half a point for that one. So question 5. What does the well-prepared army option do?
So I put get the first dice out of the bag. If you don't give your opponent the choice, you just take the first dice.
Interesting.
I put that it was either plus or minus 2 to any single roll.
Oh, that's interesting, because I've written down it may be used to add plus 2 to a single re-roll.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if it can be used as minus 2. If it's plus 2, then I probably meant minus 2. But as it's specific to a reroll, I think that's half a point regardless. But I do like your explanation for it, because that feels like that could be another army option.
Right, well prepared, I'm in a dug in position.
I just get the first one. Yeah, okay, I like that. But that's half a point for Andy, and 0 points for Josh. Okay, question 6. What is the name of the lost Boromite homeworld?
Again, I had no idea, so I put Boromosis.
Yeah, it's a solid pass from me.
Boromosis is surprisingly close. No, it's actually Borum.
Borum. Why would it not be?
Why would it not be?
I actually did know that now you said
it. Yeah, it's the lost Boromite homeworld. So so there we go. We're going to give you another half a point there,
I'll
Josh.
Again, I'm on 1 point. I've already exceeded my expectations.
What is the name of the alien race who fought the Isaurians in a real space war?
So I used my autocomplete on this and started with X, so I just went Xenakis.
Xenakis. The Xenakis.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I could not think of the name for the life of me. I even watched the Tabletop Warlords lore video on the Isaurians only a week or two ago.
Okay.
The name has passed me by completely.
Would it help... well, can either of you tell me what became of the real space alien empire that they fought?
Oh, it's the Saar, isn't it? The San-Ra.
Yeah.
And they then... Because they use the hatchlings...
Yeah,
in their own army, but they actually wiped them out in the first place.
So it's not the San-Ra, but the San-Ra is what they are termed now. It's the San-Kiri.
San-Kiri.
There you go. But I like that you went with some autocomplete, but that one isn't worth half a point, I'm afraid. So the San-Kiri.
Samsung gets half a point for that.
Question 8. What is the nickname given to the followers of the Gar Exile Shaltok? Now, this one's a tough one because you would have had to read the Drone Scourge Returns supplement in order to know this one.
The supplements that I told you I hadn't, specifically told you I hadn't read before we started recording.
True, yes. Although I did write these questions last week, so apologies. So, yeah, what is the nickname given to the followers of Gar Exile Shaltok? Only family-friendly nicknames, please.
Well, so I went for Tick because it's Tick. Shaltok.
Ah, okay. I see what you did there. Yeah. Any other answers, Andy?
I failed to write anything witty down.
Oh, that's a shame. It's Shaltok's sheep.
Oh, that makes sense.
There you go.
Followers.
Shaltok's sheep. Yeah. There you go. Question 9. This one had you thinking hard, Andy, as well. So yeah, I'm interested to see what you wrote.
I think I've mixed up two different events.
Well, let's find out. So question 9 is, what triggered the collapse of the Zon Empire during the Fourth Age? Josh, let's go with you first.
So I definitely mixed up two events, one of them being the IT crowd. And I've gone for somebody tripped on a wire that caused a system failure.
Story checks out, for sure. But no, I don't think it is the right one. Andy?
Yeah, I wrote the Isaurians' use of phase shift weaponry. And I think that's what brought the Sixth Age to an end.
That is what brought the Sixth Age to an end. So I'm willing to give you half a point just for demonstrating knowledge of the history of Antares. So let me just write that down. So it's actually the Zon Empire was ended by the Vol, who destroyed the Zon homeworld. And so the Zon Empire collapsed.
We've had some kind of question like that before. Like,
I think we have referenced the Zon at some point. Because then I think the Fifth Age, you had New Zon, was the Zon Empire rising from the ashes. So I feel like the Zon are one of those factions that you might incorporate with another model range if you were to try and bring anyone else in. But yeah, the Vol. Question 10. What is the area of the Nexus known as the Determinate? Josh.
So, serious answers only. I put somewhere we definitely know where it is, unlike the Indeterminate.
Oh, that's got to be worth a point just for just for wit.
I'm going to get overtaken by wrong answers.
Maybe. So, what have you got?
I thought it might be Imtel-based races and their area of influence.
I'm afraid it's the opposite.
The opposite.
it's actually
more of a better answer.
Yeah. Well, so the Determinate is an area of pan-human space that's controlled by neither the Concord nor the Isaurian Sanitex. It's mostly under the control of the Algorand Prosperate, though other non-Imtel societies exist there, including the Gar.
So I was on the right lines.
You were on
the wrong answer.
Yeah, it was a 50-50. Yeah. There you go. So let me just check. I didn't write down for question 8 what we got. Neither one of you got it. That's why. So, sorry, that's not me trying to rub it in. So, Andy, how many points do you think you got?
I've not been adding up as I went along. I think it was somewhere around sort of the 3, maybe 3.5.
Yeah. Josh, how many points do you think you got?
I've got a half point for Boromosis.
Right, yeah. So
style points, though. How many style points?
And just, you know, faking it till I make it was pretty high.
Probably 5-6.
I mean, you definitely, you got 2 points for style for sure.
Yeah.
If we incorporate your 2 points for style, then you won. With 3 out of 10. if we don't incorporate your points, then you only got 1 out of 10, two half points.
That's better than the 0 I was expecting.
And
so I'll take it.
Andy, you stormed ahead with 2.5 points out of 10. So yeah, that was definitely that was two record scores for sure.
I told you, I peaked at 6. It wasn't getting better than that.
So our last guest got 9.5 out of 10. Just FYI.
Yeah, but
so
our last
Andy,
guest
you're,
so Kevin Sarr.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. But I'm glad that we've now covered both ends of the spectrum, I feel. I don't feel like we're going to get much less than 1 point out of 10 from yourself. So...
Homework.
Good job. Excellent. So there you go. I'd be interested to hear from anyone who's listening what they got, providing that you're honest maybe you've got to pause after each question. I should probably have mentioned that before I started reading out the quiz questions.
Maybe in future we could have a quick fire round with buzzers and stuff as well.
That does feel like a format that would be quite chaotic.
You might
fun.
Have to make the questions a bit easier though, because then someone might actually buzz in rather than just long awkward silences.
we'll edit the long awkward silences out.
As soon as the long awkward silence goes over 2 seconds, I'm busting in with something that absolutely makes no sense.
Brilliant. That's what we like to hear. Well, on the subject of questions, we do have a few questions from listeners, so we might as well ask those before we wrap up, because we have been talking for quite a while. So from James Logan, he asked, is the app still being updated? I guess that one's targeted at me. Yes, the app is still being updated, but it's being updated infrequently, largely because of time constraints. So I work on the Warlord official app. And I work on the Fallout Wasteland Warfare official app, and I have a daytime job and a family. The Antares app is fairly low on that list of priorities, mainly because it's
selfish.
Well, selfish. I the main reason why I do update the Antares app is because I use the Antares app myself, and obviously I know a lot of people who also do use the Antares app.
It's very, very useful. Yeah,
so useful.
It's thank you. The only issue really is that it doesn't make any money, so trying to justify that time expenditure to my wife is difficult. But it does have a pending update at some point in the future, because the Vol currently aren't even in the app, and as much as adding the data is quite easy, quite quick, the Vol have some interesting rules around variable armor values and strike values and things like that that currently the app just doesn't support. So with a little time, maybe in the new year, I hope to add those to the app and then tidy anything else up. But if you are using the app and you notice anything's wrong, which is likely because I input all the data a year and a half ago and haven't necessarily kept it all up to date as new versions of the army lists are released. But if you notice anything wrong, you can email me or contact me on Facebook. So I'm Jamie Morris. You'll find me on the Antares Facebook group. And you can email antares@malaric.com, and I can update points values and stats and stuff very, very quickly, very easily, and certain other bugs I can fix as well. So yes, it's still being updated, and if you've got anything that you want to see in there, just let me know and I'll see what I can do.
We've got some questions as well pitted to us by Josh Wood, who obviously isn't here tonight.
Of course.
So my favourite one of the questions, because they all seem far too serious, is... what race would you class yourself as from the Antares universe?
Ooh, Andy?
Yeah, I'm not sure on that one. Maybe the Algorin, I think.
Yeah. Stoic.
Maybe stoic, slightly avoidant of technology.
Right, okay. Like it. I feel like I'd be Boromite because I'm slow, stocky. I'm also bald, so, you know, Boromites don't have hair. So, yeah, Boromite. What about yourself?
I'd probably say Gar. I just like sit in my battle suit, shout insults at people and hope that they can't kill me.
Oh, okay. So what about Josh Wood? Since he's not here and we can mock him mercilessly?
Ooh.
I feel like Gar as well. I feel like Gar Outcast specifically.
Just the one bloke with a lugger gun.
Yeah, just a bloke with a lugger gun. Yeah.
To be honest, I would probably put him annoyingly as like his Isaurians, because he...
Jammy.
Yeah, he is so tactical in his thinking. Oh. Like, whenever we play Bolt Action, which is a game of dice, he's normally about 6 dice pulls ahead. Oh. And he's thought of everything, and it's like... how have you got that far ahead?
He'll probably be quite flattered to hear that.
Oh yeah, he knows he's like incredibly tired. I mean, you don't finish as high as he normally does in all the tournaments I've played against him, without being as tactical as he is. He's the most tactical person I know, I think.
And I feel like every moment where he's not playing Antares, he's playing it in his head.
Yeah, and he's like one of those chess players who can play like four moves ahead and all that sort of stuff.
Brilliant.
The other question we've got from another Josh on the Facebook group is, which Josh is cooler and why is it Josh Peel? So,
which Josh was that question from?
Well, if only
Josh
we
Peel.
Knew.
Oh. If only we knew which Josh is cooler and why is it Josh Peel. Well, it's Josh Peel because you're a much less jammy winner than he is.
Yeah, I just like beat 15-year-olds and
yeah,
definitely don't shout about
there you
it.
Go.
But no.
Dave Palmer asked us, when's the next Antares Day? I feel like we shouldn't wait until next year to have it, although I do feel like having maybe a more tournament style format for an intermediate Antares Day would be fun.
I mean, by the if you think like we could look at say March next year, that's enough time that people get Christmas out of the way, they can get their Christmas forces painted up.
Yep.
It gives them that bit of time, and then also time for us to get some more games in.
Get some more locals trained up.
Absolutely. And then we could
the rules.
Yeah. Work out what we are doing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, for sure, we could look at doing more of a competitive stance to it, as opposed to that kind of... Or we do look at doing an Antares Narrative Day, where we do have the, right, you've all converged on this star system, see how you get on. Who's going to come out on top?
So actually, one of the topics we didn't cover today, because we've been talking so much about everything else, is which campaign would you like to play, whether it's a campaign of your own devising or one of the campaigns from the from version one. I feel like doing one of those original campaigns would be quite cool for an Antares Day. You wouldn't get all of the games in, so you know the Battle for Xylos is 6 games.
Yeah.
You can play some of those simultaneously, but maybe doing something like that for like maybe not an Antares Day, but an ongoing thing, because that culminates in a 6-way battle.
Oof.
Which you need like you know probably one or two umpires for. It's technically not 6-way. It's 3 adjacent 2-way battles.
Oh, okay.
That gradually move from one table to the next.
Yeah.
Trying to outrun a force field. So. And that feels like a...
Essentially playing Fortnite, but with, like...
Yeah.
Antares models.
Basically that, yeah.
That would be ideal for the setup that is out in the main gaming area as well.
Yeah.
Got 3 tables on next to each other.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You should get that booked sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think maybe, like, an Antares Day that is more narrative-focused would be quite cool, like, something like that.
Maybe in March or April.
Yeah,
Or Easter.
Yeah. I guess we just have to see how quickly we can get people to paint up their armies.
So,
the next Tale of Four Shards should be wrapping up around then. So,
that'd be good.
We'll see how that goes. Excellent. Well, that's probably all we've got time for. We have been sat here for about 3 hours.
And we've treated you to a good, like, 2 hours of us talking now, I think. So, you know, you're going to have a great podcast.
I've got a lot of editing. I've got a 16-hour flight ahead of me the day after tomorrow. So, I'm going to spend most of that just listening to your dulcet tones. Editing this podcast together, so
he'll be sick of the sound of our voices by the end of it
if he wasn't already.
Well, thank you for participating. Thank you for listening, everybody that's still with us, and look out for the next episode. We'll try to leave a little less time before we record it. I think it's been,
I imagine,
far too long.
Close to Christmas, we'll be looking to record the next one, won't we?
That makes sense to me. Well, that Christmas is just around the corner.
Maybe we've got a special edition, Christmas edition of the podcast.
Yeah. We should. And in fact, I think maybe a Christmas themed... Oh, you know what we should do? We should do like a competition. So I think maybe if we can get our listeners to send us their best Halloween or Christmas themed.
Let's go for Christmas because we'll review it around then.
A Christmas themed scenario for us to play.
A Christmas painted mini.
A Christmas painted mini. I like
best
it.
Best impressions of Commander Fartok as Santa are greatly welcomed.
Oh, my goodness, this is going to be amazing. So, essentially, anything Christmas-themed.
Yeah.
Some sort of Antares Christmas theme, whether it's a painted mini, a scenario, a bit of fanfic, that'd be good. You know,
absolutely.
Christmas on Garon Prime. in the vats where the Gar outcasts are spawned. Although they're not outcasts.
I would hate to see what the Gar equivalent of a Christmas turkey is.
Oh, God. or what Santa Claus looks like coming down the Gar chimney. Oh, they do have chimneys as well. There's the Sarissa Precision Terrain that has Gar chimneys. So
could just be...
Oh, God, yeah, and Fartok as Santa Claus. This is brilliant.
This is gold. Already, yeah.
So, yeah, send us your best Antares Christmas-themed anything, and we'll figure out a prize. It might just be mentioning your name. Maybe we can get some models to you. We'll figure something out.
Yeah, we'll sort something. I'm sure we can find something that we could get out there.
Yeah, but for the time being, happy Halloween. Yep. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
See you later, guys.
Bye.